Today in Your Health, the latest in our series on campus sexual assault. It can be hard to learn much about who commits sexual assaults on campus, and that's because only a very small number ever get reported to the police. But we wanted to find out what's known about the perpetrators and the circumstances that surround their crimes. So NPR's Laura Starczewski dug into research that gets into the minds of men who commit sexual assaults on campus. She has this report.
Psychologist David Lisak started looking into men who rape at college back in the 1980s. He surveyed about 1,800 men at UMass Boston. When the numbers came back in from that first study, Lisak was stunned. 120 men in the sample, or about 6%, had raped women they knew. Two-thirds of the guys were serial rapists, who had done this on average 6 times.
I was forced, really, to accept that, well, yes, these are college students, but there is this small percentage of college students who are sex offenders. They're behaving like sex offenders. They are sex offenders.
Together, the 120 men were responsible for 483 rapes. None of those were ever reported. So why would these guys talk to a researcher like Lisak about their crimes?
The reason that these men are not just willing, but actually were quite open about disclosing sexual assaults that they'd committed is that they don't view them as assaults. They don't view them as rape. Most of these men have an image or a myth, basically, about rape, that it's some guy in a ski mask wielding a knife. You know, they don't wear ski masks. They don't wield knives, so they don't see themselves as rapists.
I had this girl staked out. I picked her out in one of my classes, you know, worked on her. She was all prepped. I was watching for her, you know, and the minute she walked into the door of the party, I was on her.
This is an actor playing Frank, a pseudonym for a guy from Lisak's study. He's working from the actual interview transcript. Lisak says he heard the same tactics over and over again from these guys. They carefully planned their assaults. They'd ask the girls to come to a party, saying it was invite only, a big deal to nervous freshmen. And the guys' friends usually knew exactly what was going on. In fact, they'd help them prep for it.
We'd have all those kegs, but we always had some kind of punch also, you know, like our own home brew. And we'd make it with a real sweet juice and just pour in all kinds of alcohol. It was really powerful stuff. The girls wouldn't know it hit them.
Alcohol was the weapon of choice for these men, who typically saw themselves as college guys hooking up. They didn't think of what they'd done as a crime. In fact, they'd brag about it afterwards to their friends. That buy-in from friends, researchers say, is a big deal.
One of the things that matters most to boys and emerging adulthood men is the opinion of other men.
John Fobert is a researcher at Oklahoma State University. He studies rape prevention among young men. He says that in a group of guy friends, the opinions that matter so much and end up influencing behavior are often just what a guy thinks his friends think. More his perception than their actual opinions.
So let's say you have a peer group of 10 guys. One or two guys are constantly talking about, oh, I bagged this, you know, expletive. Many of the other men listening to that are uncomfortable, but they think everyone else supports it through their silence.
That silence is powerful. A number of studies from different colleges have shown that having friends who support violence against women is a major risk factor for committing sexual assault. So what if that silence could be broken before college, as early as high school?
I don't know if I'd call myself a jock. I would say I look at myself as a leader instead of a jock.
Xavier Scarlett is captain of the football team, the basketball team, and the track team. He's just about to start his senior year at West High in Sioux City, Iowa. But the past few weeks, he's been focused on getting ready to meet the incoming freshman guys.
Freshman year is so critical, because you're going to see things in high school that you probably haven't seen yet in your life.
Xavier is a mentor in a program called MVP, Mentors in Violence Prevention, which pairs up popular guys, many of them athletes, with a group of incoming freshmen who look up to them. Together, they talk through scenarios about dating, relationships, bullying, sexual assault, and rape.
You're with a girl, she's drunk, and you're sober. How does that make you feel as a guy, you know? Will you let your guy friends down by not doing anything with her?
One of the scenarios about sexual assault plays out like a story from David Lisak's study. There's a big party happening. You see a guy you know with an extremely drunk girl, and he's trying to leave with her.
Do I let them just leave, or do I grab him, or do I grab her, or do I get some friends? You know, if I say something, then my friend will judge me. He'll be mad at me for stopping him. or, you know, what will the girl say about me? Will rumors start about me in school?
Some of those scenarios, you will never see those. You'll never see them in high school.
Tucker Carroll was an MVP mentor, too. He's now a junior at Iowa State University and a member of the Delta Tau Delta fraternity. He says that once he got to Iowa State, he started seeing the scenarios play out in real life, and he was ready. The day we talked, he told me he'd used his MVP training to intervene in a situation just the night before.
I was at a going-away party last night for one of my friends that was getting shipped off to basic training.
This was at a bar in Ames, Iowa. Tucker noticed that one of the guy's cousins was pretty drunk. She was over by the jukebox with two guys who weren't part of the party. They were strangers. Tucker says he was paying attention to her body language and something didn't look right. She looked almost cornered.
What I saw last night was, you know, you kind of raise your shoulders up more, you back up a little bit more, you twist around a little bit more, kind of side to side, trying to look for which way you're trying to get out, maybe not really making eye contact with the guys at all.
Tucker's friend saw him looking over there and asked what was going on. What was Tucker seeing that he couldn't see?
He was just oblivious completely to it. And we had that discussion. He was just like, do you think she's fine?
So he enlisted that guy to help him step in. They went over to the jukebox together.
We were like, hey, let's pick a song. And, you know, we had her pick a song when we were over there and we just walked. We were like, hey, let's go back to the table and see your cousin.
And that was it. The night went on as if nothing had happened. Tucker says he's had more in-depth interventions with guys in his fraternity who've gotten out of line, who talk about women in a way that makes him uncomfortable. He'll sit down with them, sometimes even bringing a woman they've hit on into the conversation.
There's more accountability than just sending them out your front door or just saying, hey, you're just being rude, you need to leave. Like, that doesn't solve anything. It might stop the current situation, but that doesn't stop it from happening again.
There are only a few dozen high schools around the country that offer the MVP program. It's been embedded in public high schools in Sioux City, Iowa for more than 10 years, but researchers have yet to evaluate how effective it is in reducing incidents of sexual violence. David Lisak says there's strong evidence, though, that this kind of training is urgently needed in high schools.
We also have research now that confirms that the vast majority of these serial offenders started committing sexual assaults in high school, at least.
Lisak says that by the time 18-year-olds leave for college, they need to be hearing this kind of challenge from their guy friends.
This idea that getting somebody intoxicated, plastered, whatever you want to call it, so that you can have sex with them, is an idea that we just simply are going to have to confront and challenge and erode. Just as we have challenged and eroded the idea that it's fun and perfectly fine to get drunk and get in your car. You know, we really have changed how normative that is and how acceptable that is in a matter of, what, 2 to 3 decades.
John Fobert, the researcher in Oklahoma, says it's important to remember that 90% of men have never committed rape. The key is opening their eyes to what's going on with the other 10% so they can see it and respond. Laura Starcheski, NPR News.
In nearby Ferguson, Missouri, demonstrations and unrest have once again delayed the opening of school. Today, district officials announced that Ferguson won't start classes until August 25th. This morning, instead of being in the classroom, about 150 local teachers walked the streets. They were helping clean up from overnight clashes between protesters and police. NPR's Elise Hugh reports on this unusual professional development day.
Arthur Vambekeets should be teaching 8th grade civics. Instead, he's taking some civic action of his own, helping clean up the streets where his students live and hang out.
Well, our kids are off school, but we wanted to come and have professional development, and then part of the day we're going to come here and help pick up trash.
So far, as he and dozens of his fellow educators move down West Florissant Avenue, a street lined with boarded-up businesses, he's found broken glass, empty water bottles, and the occasional tear gas canister.
It says defense technology on it.
The unrest in this St. Louis area town straddles two school districts, Ferguson and Jennings. Since some Jennings schools border parts of the hub of street clashes and bursts of violence, the district called off classes early Tuesday morning. Officials notified parents with phone calls and text messages. Special ed teacher Maya Moore says the situation's too dangerous.
Our students have no buses in the district. We walk to school. So as a safety concern, our children come first.
It's also a district where a majority of students live below the poverty line. So many Jennings kids rely on free and reduced lunch that even though classes are canceled, the meals aren't.
We're one of several schools that are closed today, and we're probably the only school giving lunch.
Tiffany Anderson is the Jennings School District superintendent. She organized the teachers, helping clean up, has kept meal deliveries going for students with special needs, and is making sure mental health services are at the ready.
Kids are facing challenges. This is unusual, but violence, when you have over 90% free reduced lunch, is not unusual. You know, last week I met with several high school students, some of whom were out here helping clean up, and, you know, we talked a little bit about how you express and have a voice in positive ways.
On neighborhood streets, young people are expressing themselves. Leslie Adams is 12. She's out of class because she's a Jennings student. With her mom nearby, she shows off a handmade sign decorated with pink glitter. It reads, "Hands up, don't shoot." The nightly police clashes happen around the corner from where she and her friends play.
At first, I was absolutely scared. Like, I was so scared. But then, since I was watching the news, I understood that it was history that was going on. And for my age and kids younger, we can grow up to learn our different histories about it.
The social studies teacher, Arthur Vambekeets, says he's going to be talking through the still-unfolding civic event with his students.
There's definitely a class issue here, just as much as there is a race issue. So, you know, there has to be some kind of legislative action taken.
The calls for action range widely in this community. Demands of justice can mean so many things. Some locals want the county prosecutor replaced. Others call for the arrest of Darren Wilson, the police officer who shot and killed Michael Brown. The educators want to provide support during a difficult time.
We like to tell kids we're a lifeline, and that's really the message that we're giving today. We're a lifeline, and everyone in this community is a lifeline.
This school year isn't starting out like the rest, but teachers hope some lasting lessons will come out of it. Elise Hugh, NPR News, Ferguson, Missouri.
And now a tale of two polls. Both are new, and both attempt to capture the public's opinion of the Common Core state standards.
These are benchmarks in English and math for K-12 students that were really little known this time last year, but they have since become the subject of a high-profile political fight, and now a majority of the public opposes them.
That is, if you believe poll number one, out today. But poll number two, released yesterday, found a majority still supports the core.
Okay, so which poll is wrong, or could they both be right? Corey Turner from the NPR Ed team tried to figure this out.
Poll number one is a joint effort between Gallup and Phi Delta Kappa, or PDK. They've been doing this annual education poll for 46 years. In last year's poll, the Common Core was the new kid in class that nobody knew. That's changed, says Bill Bouchard, head of PDK.
Last year, two-thirds hadn't even heard the words together. Now 80% indicate that they know about the core.
And that new kid now has an image problem.
60% of the respondents oppose the core.
But why? Well, roughly half of respondents said they learned about the core from TV, newspapers, and radio. And critics, like commentator Glenn Beck, have used all three to wage a public campaign against the core. Poll number one found that misconceptions are, well, common among opponents. A majority said they believe the standards were initiated by the federal government. They worry the core will result in a national curriculum and national tests. And their biggest fear, says Bill Bouchard,
those in opposition felt that it would limit what teachers could teach locally.
Poll number two comes from Education Next, a journal sponsored by Harvard's Kennedy School, the Hoover Institution at Stanford, and the Thomas B. Fordham Institute. While this poll found many of the same misconceptions about the core, I want to focus on the big difference between the polls. It comes in the most important question, whether people support or oppose the core. Poll number one asks it this way. Do you favor or oppose having the teachers in your community use the Common Core state standards to guide what they teach? The result? 60% said they oppose, which isn't all that surprising since the question hits on what we know is respondents' greatest fear, that the core will somehow limit teachers. Here's how poll number two did it. Get ready. It's so long, I asked one of the poll's designers, Professor Paul Peterson of Harvard, to read it for me.
As you may know, in the last few years, states have been deciding whether or not to use the Common Core, which are standards for reading and math that are the same across the states. In the states that have these standards, they will be used to hold public schools accountable for their performance. Do you support or oppose the use of the Common Core standards in your state?
Notice when he said, states have been deciding whether or not to use the Common Core. That makes clear, no federal takeover here. The other big difference is the bit about how the standards will be used to hold public schools accountable. That idea of accountability polls really well with Americans. Remember, in poll number one, support for the core was just over 30%. In poll number two, support hit 53%. Poll number two also did something tricky. Peterson's team put the same "do you support" question to a different group of people, but without using the words Common Core. Guess what happened? Support jumped from 53% to 68%. Drop those two toxic words, add 15 points. Which question in which poll is the right question? Again, here's Paul Peterson of poll number two.
Well, I've studied survey research since I was in graduate school some 40 years ago. And the first thing you learn is that there is no right way to ask a question.
But can both polls be right? Can a majority of Americans oppose and support the Common Core? In a word, yes. Because when it comes to polling, a word can make all the difference. Corey Turner, NPR News, Washington.